You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 289, Exodus 20, part 3. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Pretty good. Pretty good. Can't complain.
Yeah. Well, we're just a few weeks away from our Naked Bible Conference, our second one. So getting geared up for that, excited for that. So can't wait to see everybody that's coming out. It'll be fun.
Yeah, it'll be fun. It was fun last year, so I'm looking forward to it, too. I don't expect any different.
Yeah, it was fun last year. And also, Mike, don't forget that if you can't physically make it this year, you can always stream it live. So go to nakedbibleconference.com. I think it'll be available for 3 months after the conference, so you can watch it over and over anytime that you want on demand. So go to nakedbibleconference.com and live stream it.
Yeah, yeah. I'm looking forward to it, just meeting people and listening. I mean, it's one of the times of year I get to listen to presentations too, so I'm really looking forward to it.
All right, Mike. Well, this week, part three, is this the final part of Exodus 20?
This is the final part, yes, for Exodus 20. So, yep, you know, it took us three times to get through it. We got six commands to cover today, so we're going to be here a little while. But I think people will find this interesting because on the one hand, you know, you kind of assume that they're pretty straightforward, and some of them are. But then there are others that are a little difficult to define, and there are even exceptions, biblical exceptions to some of the commands. So that is often new. I remember when I taught, you know, ethics, you know, we would, you know, spend, you know, a day at least on 10 commandments, you know, and people were surprised that there were actually, again, exceptions sort of built into them. And, you know, we've actually seen that already in the previous part, part two, when we got into the first four commands, where we had the command about, you know, not making graven images, you know, idols, so to speak, or an image of anything, you know, in the heavens above and on the earth and under the earth and all that. Well, you know, then a few chapters later, you know, God commands that cherubim be made, or even the menorah, you know, the golden lampstand, you know, you could lump that in here too. So these are religious objects, certainly of things on the earth or, you know, in the heavens above the earth, in the case of the cherubim. So how is that not a violation, you know, of the command? Well, it wasn't a violation, as we saw last time, because the real issue was, you know, Israelites were not to bow down to or worship any of them. They were to bow down only to the uncreated creator. You know, and God himself shows up. I mean, this isn't like fashioning anything, but God does show up as a man, you know, which is, of course, is certainly an earthly thing. And so God is in, you know, human form. You know, how is that consistent, you might say, you know, with this idea that God is unrepresentable, you know, in these commands, these early commands. So, you know, we talked about that last time, you know, that here you have what seems to be kind of clear cut, but then you've got these other things that sort of impede on it that require some unpacking to show, you know, really to learn, you know, well, what was the real basis, you know, for the command here? And we're going to get that again today with some of these commands, not all of them, but some of them. So the real takeaway here is that the Ten Commandments themselves actually have context. You know, they're not just sort of dropped in our laps and there's nothing to think about here. There's actually plenty to think about in a number of instances. So they have a context in which they themselves need to be understood. You know, mostly it's a wider context that once you get into the wider context, it reveals, you know, some exceptions or helps you sort of narrow down what the command actually means, what the point was. You know, and so that's often new to people. And we're going to see more of that today. So we might as well just jump right in with the fifth command. This is going to be Exodus 20, verse 12 is really our starting point, where it says, "Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you." So this is the fifth command. Asarna, who we have referenced before, and we will reference several times today in his Jewish Publication Society commentary on Exodus, has, again, I think, a good summary. I really like, you know, Sarna's commentary in a number of respects. He writes this: this command forms the transition from the first to the second group of divine declarations, in that it simultaneously possesses both religious and social dimensions. It shares with the preceding command the formula, the Lord your God, and also the relationship of Israel to God is often expressed metaphorically in filial terms, like in family terms. Let me just break in here. We have this honor your father and your mother, and then that's linked to the land that the Lord your God is giving you. So there's this sort of boots on the ground kind of thing. You know, it has to do with your relationships one to another, but there's also this overarching relationship to God expressed in the land. And this isn't new. At Exodus 4:22, this is the passage where, you know, God refers to Israel as his son. Okay, so there you have like a family sort of terminology there. Jeremiah 31:20, is Ephraim my dear son? Question, is he my darling child? These are rhetorical questions. Hosea 11:1, you know, when Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son, so on and so forth. So you get this family language where ultimately what's being talked about is the relationship of God and then the covenant promises, one of which was the land, so on and so forth. So you get a little bit of that here. Back to Sarna, he says, the same verbs of honoring and revering are used in expressing proper human attitudes to both God and parents. So the same verbs in the Hebrew Bible are used to both how you relate to parents and how you relate to God. So this command is sort of a bridge of the sort of the two halves, even though they're not equal halves of the commands, you know, the first four and then the next six. Relationship to God, relationship to other imagers, you know, other people. So just by way of example, Exodus 21:17, whoever curses his father or his mother shall be put to death. So, I mean, there you have a very obvious one about revering parents. Leviticus 29 is the same way. Deuteronomy 21, again, about the rebellious son. We're going to get into some of these, you know, where it talks about relating, you know, to parents in a certain way. But you also get the same kind of language in Leviticus 24. Those were laws about blaspheming God. I mean, earlier, you know, the one I just read and some of that I just referenced are about, you know, to use, for lack of a better way to put it, not blaspheming or not, you know, cursing your parents. Well, the same language is used of God, like in Leviticus 24, Numbers 15, and so on. So we get this, the language in both, which, as Sarna is pointing out, is kind of a bridge between the two halves. He writes, in fact, the obligation to respect is enjoined only for God and parents, and the offender in either instance is liable to the extreme penalty. The parallels point up the supreme importance that the Torah assigns to the integrity of the family for the sake of the stability of society and generational continuity. Family life is the bedrock on which Jewish society stands. No other item in the Decalogue is similarly formulated wholly in positive terms, and for none other is there a promise of reward. So this one, the fifth command, honor your father and mother, there's some special characteristics to it that, you know, link that command to the way we should revere and honor God. Now, a few comments here, just to sort of get into the weeds. You have an honor your father and mother. There's no hint here. If you really think about it, there's no hint that the command has a time limit. Just says, honor your father and mother, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. It doesn't say, honor your father and mother until, and then there's some limit. Okay, there's no hint that the command has a time limit. There's no hint that it expires when children reach a certain age, or that one parent is valued above the other. Again, Sarna notes elsewhere, the command applies equally to son and daughter, irrespective of their age, and it holds for both parents, end of quote. So the question, of course, is what does honor mean? Does it mean obey in every circumstance? Now, we get a little help here from other verses in the Torah that speak to the treatment of parents, you know, one of which I've already, you know, quoted a little bit, but Exodus 21:15, that's the one we quoted, whoever strikes his father or mother shall be put to death. Leviticus 20, verse 9, anyone who curses his father and his mother shall surely be put to death. He has cursed his father or his mother, his blood is upon him. Now, the verb for cursing there, in Hebrew, it's the lema kalal, and it's in something called the PL stem. Now, the PL stem, sorry for the little Hebrew grammar digression here, is often characterized by grammarians as factative in its semantic. And what factative means is that it points, you would have a verb that when the action of the verb is performed, it leads to a certain specific end result. So in this case, since the verb for curse is put in this particular Hebrew stem, that has the end result in mind, often in its semantics. The idea is that cursing your parents results in their being put in a state of being demeaned or humiliated. Okay, this is what you're not supposed to do. Leviticus 19:3 reads as follows, every one of you shall revere his mother and his father, and you shall keep my Sabbaths. I am the Lord. Revere here is the Hebrew word yara, which means generically to fear. We get the verb in Leviticus 19:30. Again, just to reference that, you shall keep my Sabbaths and reverence my sanctuary. Okay. Leviticus 26:2, also referencing the sanctuary. So are Israelites really supposed to be afraid of the sanctuary? No, they're supposed to revere it. That revere is a good translation. You're supposed to avoid desecrating it. You're supposed to avoid, you know, defiling it in any way, bringing sacred space into a state of being common. Okay, you know, lowering it, bringing it down, making it low, demeaning it. So revere is actually a pretty good, you know, translation. So this is what we're not supposed to be doing to parents. Deuteronomy 27:16, we get a different verb, kala, which means to degrade, despise, or treat with contempt. And that verse says, cursed be anyone who dishonors, kala, his father or his mother. So this helps us, you know, get some sort of a framework, you know, for how these verbs are used in the fifth command. You know, don't humiliate. Don't, you know, do the opposite of revere. You know, don't demean. Okay, this is what you're not supposed to do. Don't bring your parents down. Bring them low. You know, they're supposed to be treated as special. It's the same verbs that you would use for treating God. So don't treat them as common, you know, like everybody else, you know, so that they're humiliated and demeaned or whatnot. So, you know, we need to sort of have those things in mind, let Scripture, as best we can, try to define Scripture. The other factor that we need to think about is the Bible's own view of marriage and how this sort of works out in biblical history. You know, you have the leave and cleave language of Genesis, for instance. You know, a man will leave, you know, his father and mother, he'll leave his, you know, one family and then be, you know, cleave to his wife and then, of course, start a new family. Well, again, just because you're married and you have a new family unit, that doesn't excuse you from the fifth command. Again, you just read it, it's pretty straightforward. There are no limitations or exceptions and so on and so forth. But we still don't quite know what the command means to honor your father and mother. Like, how do we do that? And how do we transgress that? How would we know? So I bring up the leave and cleave thing because, yeah, it establishes a new family unit. But in Israelite culture, even in urban settings, you know, urban settings when they're actually living in cities, as opposed to patriarchal, you know, when they're living in tents, okay? Even in urban settings, the new family units typically in the patriarchal era lived in the same tent. They lived under the same tent roof. You know, you just essentially added to the tent or partitioned it off so that the man and his wife now have their own space, you know, within the patriarch's tent, you know, his house, as it were. Or, you know, as the parents aged, you know, they weren't sent off, you know, to some other, you know, living accommodation. They stayed with the family, either in the same tent or in the same house, again, when we're in an urban setting. So you often have parents living in the home, you know, parents and these other units, these other family units living together. It's an extended family living situation. And, you know, even when the leadership of the family or the clan passes on to the eldest son or whoever, you know, has the right of the firstborn conferred to them, okay? Even in that situation, the parents are still going to be there. So you have the presence of both one or both parents in the home, and that kind of changes the dynamic, or at least it's a factor that needs to be considered. Regardless, you know, of who, you know, has leadership, you know, of the family or the clan, the parents were not supposed to be demeaned or belittled. Again, even when some other son effectively ran the home and the family's property, the parents, especially the father, had reverential leadership status. In our day and age, you know, really in modern society in general, the circumstances are often quite different. You know, those set of circumstances really aren't going to play out, at least in modern Western society, really in the same way. You know, so there is a different dynamic here. Let's take another, you know, angle at this. So we've got kind of what the verbiage means: don't demean, don't humiliate, don't belittle, you know, again, treat as special, stated positively. We've got a situation where that's what the words mean. There's no limitations or exceptions in the command. The dynamic is a little bit unfamiliar to us because the parents basically stay with the children and the children with the parents their whole lives. Another bit of a rabbit trail. Well, let's look at it at a different way. There is one passage, the Deuteronomy 21 passage. This is Deuteronomy 21, 18 to 21, where the command apparently does mean obey the parent, where the child is supposed to obey the parent. And we actually have an adult child in the context. So we need to factor this in as well. So let me read Deuteronomy 21, 18 through 21. This is obviously a negative example. But it says, if a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and though they discipline him, will not listen to them, then his father and his mother shall take hold of him and bring him out to the elders of his city at the gate of the place where he lives. And they shall say to the elders of his city, this our son is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. Then all the men of the city shall stone him to death with stones. So you shall purge the evil from your midst, and all Israel shall hear and fear. It's like, yeah, I guess they would. Now, the context there seems to be one where the son is an adult, at least a young adult, because he's referred to as getting drunk. You know, he's a drunkenness problem. And the son is undermining the family unit by being a drain on resources or just refusing correction. You know, he's not a little kid where they could chastise him in some, you know, physical way or isolate him in some way or take away privileges, you know, that kind of thing. We have what seems to be an adult relationship here, an adult child. Because of the emphasis in other passages in regard to the prohibition of demeaning parents or treating them with contempt, we might presume that, you know, obviously this is what's going on here. I mean, why else would they essentially have to take him to the law, as it were? You know, they're being treated with contempt. This is part of the picture. So the parents in this case do not take matters into their own hands, but instead they take the son to the tribal elders, which in effect in Israel was law enforcement, and put his fate, the son's fate, into their hands. They turn him over. And now the legal system's going to do with him what the legal system does. We, of course, today might have to do the same thing, you know, with a child. In other words, let the legal system handle that kid. And they might do something where, you know, going to law enforcement is appropriate and merited. The passage is therefore an endorsement of the idea that parents may need to resort to these means, to law enforcement. It's not an endorsement of the system of law enforcement or the penalty. It's an endorsement of the idea that, you know, hey, when you have an adult son like this who's, again, treating you with contempt, you may have to just take them to the authorities and let the authorities deal with him. Now, we aren't a theocratic state, obviously, and the theocracy was by definition, I've said this a number of times in the podcast, the theocracy was by definition planned to be obsolete. It's planned obsolescence. At least if we care to think about where all the covenants were supposed to lead to the reunification of the nations, which meant a circumcision neutral people of God brought back into the family through a savior, which is Jesus. Okay. This is where salvation history was always supposed to go. the theocracy is sort of a way station along the road to, you know, that God is intending here. So God's plan was never to reinstitute or to institute a theocracy that would endure for all time. And that's how, you know, things are going to go now. No, it was supposed to lead somewhere. The theocracy was a stopping point, a way station. You know, and even as far back as the Abrahamic covenant, the Gentiles were in the picture. Jacob's blessing in Genesis 48 came through, which we talked about, you know, in earlier episodes about the reference to Ephraim. The Gentiles were supposed to be part of this. So from the very beginning, the plan was not an Israelite theocracy. So to say that God ordained a theocracy, and this is God's ordained form of the way that his kingdom family is supposed to be on earth, is wrong. You basically have to ignore not only the way salvation history played out, you have to ignore the way it was intended to play out. That's my point here. So I continually, you know, kind of go back to this because we get stuck on these passages like, oh, well, unless we turn our kids over and the kid gets capital punishment, we're not obeying the Bible. Well, again, just rip that thing out of context and pretend a theocracy was, you know, supposed to be, you know, the way things were supposed to, you know, play out in God's plan. Let's just pretend that. It's wrong. Okay, it's just wrong-headed, it's misguided, it's out of context interpretation. So what we have here is not an endorsement of a particular culture or even a particular form of government that God was at one point behind. What we have here is an endorsement of the idea that parents may actually have to let somebody else deal with their kids. That's what it is. We're at that point now. You know, this is an important principle that the Torah, okay, the Bible, you know, the wider Bible, does not endorse a specific culture. Hebrew culture, okay, and I realize I'm striking at the Hebrew roots people, and I don't mind doing that because they're wrongheaded. All right, here, you know, God does not endorse theocracy for the church, for his, you know, for believers through all time. Well, it's the Torah. Well, yeah, I know it's the Torah. If you'd read the Torah, like Genesis 48 and Genesis 12, you would know that Gentile inclusion was always in the picture. You would know that. And Gentile inclusion is a circumcision neutral thing. Because elsewhere in the Bible, you know, we have Gentiles becoming priests of the Most High. You know, this is all part of the picture. So to pick one period of Israelite history and one facet of salvation history, in this case, theocracy, and say, this is the way God wanted it from the beginning to the end, it's just wrong. It just is. And so that's important when you get into things like the commands, and because the commands are the foundation for ethics. And the whole issue of, well, you know, when now that we have the church now, which is a circumcision neutral thing, you know, what are we supposed to do with the Torah? And the Torah was planned obsolescence, the theocracy. Now, the moral laws of the Torah get carried into the New Testament. We know that. That makes sense because it's just morality. But the specific laws of the theocracy do not, because they are bound, tied to, they are operative within a theocratic state, which was never the designed endpoint. Again, so this is important. I would say this in regard to honoring the father and the mother. Again, having gone on that little rabbit trail, but again, that's going to help us, you know, at some points in the rest of the episode. The command, you know, to honor father and mother may not have a scriptural limit, but it does have practical limits. So we need to get real here. And, you know, what I'm going to say here would have been logically applied, you know, in the theocratic state as well. I mean, people kind of know when, let's say, the parents are just not functioning like they are, you know, like they should be. There might be a health problem, you know, something like that. I mean, people are people. We try to not treat parents with contempt. We want to make sure they're not belittled. This is what these verbs mean in the command. They don't mean to obey at all times in every circumstance, regardless of how absurd or abhorrent it might be. So let's get real. The command wasn't given so that a parent or parents with dementia would have to be obeyed, no matter how irrational they have become. That's just real life. You know, if your parent in Israelite society is commanding you to sin, sorry. But the fifth command, and no command of God, I will add, is given so that you enable evil to proliferate. No command is given so that evil gets help. And that is not the point of any command, including the Ten Commandments. You know, and when we have a situation where, you know, someone is obviously debilitated, okay, this is real life. You know, it doesn't, you know, the command doesn't require slavish obedience by children when a parent wants to do evil or wants the child to do evil. The first authority is God, and God is omniscient. God actually knows when it's in a parent's best interest to not let that parent have authority. God knows the circumstances. He's not surprised by any of these things. Sometimes we read these commands, again, as if they require us to check our brain in at the door or ignore a real life circumstance. God knows the circumstances you are in. So, you know, I know believers often struggle with this, you know, how to honor a parent's wishes. You know, when do I say no to a parent? Because I just know that if I say yes, it's going to really be bad. You know, it's going to be destructive, not only to my parents, but to somebody else. You know, what do I do? Again, God knows the circumstances. He's not learning anything when he looks at your situation. He knows. He knows the circumstances you're in. He knows the motivation of your heart as well. And sometimes to honor a parent means making a decision contrary to their wishes. Just like as a parent, sometimes letting a child suffer the circumstances of their behavior is the best thing in the long-term interest of the child. So having the best interest of the parent in mind is what the command is really about. That is honoring the parent. That is making them, you know, giving them the benefit of the doubt in every way possible. We are not treating them like they're some ordinary person. They have special status. This is why we're struggling with the decision. If it was somebody else, we wouldn't struggle at all. Okay, we're struggling with the decision because this is the, you know, our parent or parents. We're trying to make the best decision for them. God knows the real motivation in our heart. He knows the things that we, you know, say and don't say that are just floating around in our head. God knows all that. So we do need to be careful about the decisions we make in regard to parents, you know, especially when they get, you know, to a certain stage in life. Because God does know, and we will be accountable, you know, either in this life, you know, or you know, we will suffer loss, you know, when it comes to reward in heaven because of the decisions we make. I mean, we're not going to get away with anything is the point. So we do need to be careful. We need to do the best job we can to honor them. But sometimes the best way to honor them is to say no or come up with some alternative. And God knows that. Again, God isn't learning anything here. God actually knows the circumstances and he knows what's in your heart. He sees everything and he knows everything. He knows if you're really acting in self-interest. He knows if you're taking pleasure in your parents' displeasure. He knows all that. God is not fooled and he will not be mocked. So the bottom line is that this command, which doesn't expire, speaks not of handing absolute dictatorial authority to parents, no matter their situation or no matter what they want. That isn't the point. Rather, it speaks of not belittling or demeaning them, treating them in the best way possible with the circumstances being what they are. Don't treat them with contempt. Treat them well, as best you can, God being your witness. You know, and that's tough sometimes. Let's move on to command number 6. You shall not murder. This is Exodus 20:13. Now that's the ESV. The exceptions in this command are discernible by virtue of that translation. You shall not murder, as opposed to other translations that say something like you shall not kill. Now, if you're going to translate the verse you shall not kill, that produces conundrums or conundra. When you look at the rest of the Bible does command taking the lives of animals, for instance, sacrifice. If you're going to, thou shalt not, I mean, I've actually heard people say, thou shalt not kill, you know, we need to be vegan, you know, thou shalt not kill. Well, is that really what the command means? Because God actually did command sacrifices. So you got a problem here, dude. God also commands taking the life, taking human life in war, or the life of anyone who has committed a capital crime, you know, both within Israel and even before we get to the theocracy. Now, Sarna nicely summarizes why murder, which is the taking of an innocent life, a life that has done nothing deserving of death in a legal sense. He talks about why that is in view biblically, and of course, this is with respect to human beings. He writes this, the Hebrew stem ratzach, as noted by Rashbam and Bekor Shor, these are two rabbinic authorities, applies only to illegal killing, and unlike other verbs for the taking of life, is never used in the administration of justice or for killing in war. Now, let me read that again. The verb here in the command, ratzach, is never used in the administration of justice or for killing in war in the Hebrew Bible. That's a significant point. Also, it is never employed when the subject of the action is God or an angel. God never murders, and his angel never murders either. They never ratzach. This command, therefore, cannot be used to justify either pacifism or the abolition of the death penalty, both of which, Sarna writes, would have to be argued on other grounds. In other words, you know, that's the end of the Sarna quote. In other words, he's saying it's illegitimate to argue, again, for those things, pacifism or to abolish the death penalty, on the basis of this command. You're going to have to do it some other way. You know, and again, I think that's a significant point, you know, to bring up as far as, you know, the discussion, because this command does get used in the wider culture for those causes. And they're just not, again, if you're just taking the verse and you're not looking at any other verses, you're not looking at where the verb is used or not used anywhere else, okay, then thou shalt not kill, you know. No, that by definition would be taking the command out of context, and that's what Sarna is objecting to. Now, he adds an interesting side note that takes us into the social ethical application of the command. He writes, Genesis 9:6 provides the rationale for the prohibition on murder and taking an innocent life. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for in his image did God make man. This means, Sarna writes, that society must exact satisfaction for the crime of murder because life, being derived from God, is infinitely precious and is his alone to give and to take. By his unspeakable act, the murderer usurps the divine prerogative and infringes upon God's sovereignty. And because human beings are created in the divine image, he also affronts God's majesty. For this reason, it is not in the power of human beings to forgive a murderer or to commute the death penalty into ransom, as Numbers 35:31 makes clear. Let me read you that verse. He's speaking now of, you know, Israelites and those who are going to follow the Torah here. Numbers 35:31 says, "Moreover, you shall accept no ransom for the life of a murderer who is guilty of death. He shall be put to death." So there were other commands. You know, we talked about this in the Leviticus series that could be downgraded. You know, could be the penalty could be adjusted in some way. Murder is not one of those, and it's for these reasons that Sarna is articulating. Now he adds before we end his quote. In practice, however, at least in Second Temple times, imposition of the death penalty was a rare occurrence. That is also true. It was rarely ever carried out. So we're not going to do an episode on whether the Second Temple Judaism was, you know, fudging on the Torah. You know, I think it's fair to say in this regard that, you know, they were when they don't do this. But Sarna's bigger point is that, look, the rationale for this is rooted in Genesis 9:6, which is pre-Mosaic, and it's rooted in the image of God and God's own authority. Okay, life is from him, and he alone has the authority to give it and to take it legitimately. Okay, now Wenham also comments on this. This is the Word Biblical Commentary, and his thoughts echo those of Sarna, but he has a little bit of nuancing in here. He writes, the precise meaning of the sixth commandment depends on the definition of ratzach. This verb occurs just over 40 times in the Old Testament, far less frequently than the more general terms, harag, to kill, to slay, or to destroy, which occurs more than 160 times, and the hifil of the verb mut, cause to die, i.e. kill, which occurs more than 200 times. Ratzach plainly refers to killing that can be understood to be murder, and some translators so render it. But Ratzach can also refer to unintentional killing, i.e. manslaughter, as in Deuteronomy 19, 3, 4, and 6, and Joshua 20, verse 3. And therefore, it extends to the legal execution of a convicted killer, as in Numbers 35, 30. One could therefore conclude that Ratzach is a verb of specialized application referring to killing that brought illegal violence into the covenant community. Such a general understanding of Ratzach fits its pattern of usage in the Old Testament. The verb refers only to the killing of persons, never to animals, and it can refer to capital punishment, but not to killing in war. Okay, so there you go. Again, you know, manslaughter, because it, you know, again, it's not legitimate killing. It's not something that God through the law would sanction. So manslaughter is still an illegal taking of life, but the penalty for that was different than premeditated murder. You know, and again, without getting into all the laws, those of us who have read, you know, through the Torah, you know that these things were treated differently. So when it comes to thou shalt not murder, there are exceptions if we understand what ratzach actually means and how it is used and how it is never used. So I think, again, that discussion, getting into the word a little bit, you know, helps us understand, and incorporating the wider context helps us understand what the command means and what it doesn't. Let's go to the seventh command. You shall not commit adultery. Now, obviously, you're going to wonder, you know, well, what's not clear there? You know, where's the ambiguity? What could possibly be an exception to this? Well, we'll get there. Now, Wenham writes, again, this is Word Biblical Commentary, and this kind of sets up the discussion. Wenham says, the ancient Near Eastern attitude toward adultery has been surveyed by, you know, a number of scholars, and he gives their names. They have commented respectively on texts from Egypt and Ugarit in which, as in the Old Testament, adultery is referred to by the discreet euphemism, quote, the great sin, unquote. The Hebrew verb for this great sin and the verb of the seventh commandment is na'af, to commit adultery. It is used in the Old Testament with both men and women as subject, though far more frequently of men, and by analogy as a designation of idol worship, the violation of the bond of covenant relationship with Yahweh. Great sin, quote unquote, is used in the Old Testament of both those betrayals. That's the end of the Wenham quote. So that's kind of interesting. The Old Testament refers to adultery as the great sin, and the other place that expression is, you know, reserved for is idolatry. Again, that's just a really interesting observation. Now, for the purposes of our discussion, and the exception that I've sort of alluded to, we need to understand something from the outset, how the Old Testament defines adultery. I'm going to tell you right now, and this might be news to some of you, the Old Testament, the Torah, defines adultery in a way that we don't. You know, we're actually more prohibitive in this regard than the Old Testament is. Here's what I mean. Here's how the Old Testament defines adultery. This is where you're going to see na'af used, these contexts. Number one, a man having sex with the wife of another man. Okay, I'll just read an example with each. Leviticus 18:20. You shall not lie sexually with your neighbor's wife, and so make yourself unclean with her. Okay, so a man having sex with the wife of another man, that's adultery. Number two, a man having sex with a woman betrothed or engaged to another man. That's Deuteronomy 22, 23 through 27. If there is a betrothed virgin, and a man meets her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out to the gate of that city. And you shall stone them to death with stones, the young woman because she did not cry for help though she was in the city, and the man because he violated his neighbor's wife. Now, you see there, betrothed virgin is defined as neighbor's wife. Engagement was just like being married. Okay, but the passage continues, but if in the open country a man meets a young woman who is betrothed and the man seizes her and lies with her, then only the man who lay with her shall die. Again, the presumption is that she cried out. You shall do nothing to the young woman. She has committed no offense punishable by death. For this case is like that of a man attacking and murdering his neighbor. Because he met her in the open country, and though the betrothed young woman cried for help, there was no one to rescue her. So that's different. That's rape, okay? So the key point here is that betrothed woman is defined as neighbor's wife in that passage. So that's two. So how does the Old Testament define adultery? A man having sex with a wife of another man, a man having sex with a woman betrothed to another man. Third, it defines adultery as a married woman, willingly having sex with a man who is not her husband. Okay. And this is where like Hosea and Ezekiel pick up on the idolatry, the spiritual adultery thing, you know, playing the whore, that kind of language. So we've got three trajectories that define adultery in the Torah. Now, it should be obvious what isn't included here. What's not included is a married man taking another woman or a series of women to be additional wives, so long as none of them are married or betrothed to someone else, to another man. That's not adultery in the Old Testament context. It's never defined as adultery. The key is, again, whether the woman was married or, again, engaged. Now, this is no surprise, given the patriarchal polygamous culture into which God inserts himself when calling his people out of Egypt. Okay, you know, God, you know, shows up while they're in Egypt. You know, he had talked to the patriarchs before, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You know, God never tells them, now look, I'd really love to have a covenant with you, but you need to not be patriarchal and polygamous in your culture first. And then we can talk about having a relationship. Then we can talk about me using you to kickstart the kingdom of God. I got to start somewhere, so I'm starting with you. But before I can start, you got to not be polygamists. God never does that. The culture is incidental. God doesn't create the culture. He invades it. He inserts himself into it, and he calls, you know, Abraham. He enables Abraham and Sarah to have a child. You know, he punishes, you know, I mean, it doesn't go well when Abraham goes outside the bounds of what God had told him, but taking Hagar at Sarah's suggestion. Again, that was a normal suggestion. That's why Abraham doesn't recoil in horror when Sarah, who isn't getting pregnant, says, well, why don't you just take Hagar? Maybe that's what God meant. You know, you have a kid, you know. God wants you to have a kid. He promised you to have a kid, so go take Hagar. And Abraham's like, yeah, okay, that makes sense. I mean, he doesn't recoil in horror because it's already part of their culture. But God has to intervene and said, look, this wasn't the point. The point is that Sarah is the chosen one because she is barren, and I'm going to supernaturally enable her to have a child. Okay, so, you know, this is part of the culture. God doesn't create the culture. Well, it's in the Bible. Yeah, it's in the Bible. Lots of things are recorded in the Bible that God doesn't come up with. This is one of them. There are lots of these cultural things God doesn't create and come up with. They just are when God invades the setting, when God enters into the picture. And so you got their descendants down in Egypt for 400 years, and God, you know, calls Moses, the burning bush, and says, hey, I need you to go down there, and I'm going to let, you know, deliver my people, and so on and so forth. He doesn't go with a message that, hey, God's really interested in taking you out of here, but you got to get rid of the polygamy thing. Again, it's absurd. But yet we read the Bible this way. They don't have any law on anything until Moses. There's no patriarchal law that's codified. And I know all the Noahide law stuff, you know, we sort of make up the idea that this gets codified, and it doesn't. There's nothing in the Bible about that. That is rabbinic tradition. And frankly, it's an overread of the Noah passage as well. We did a Fringe Pop episode on that. If you were interested in my thoughts on that, you can go watch that. But we have here a situation where, again, we have a polygamous culture. Patriarchs were polygamous. That's just the way it was. God doesn't bother to change the culture when choosing these men to start anew his plan for people on earth. Now, we get eventually Genesis 1 and 2. And I think Genesis 1 through 11 was written or heavily edited much later than the Mosaic era. I've said that many times in the podcast because of all the very explicit and specific Babylonian polemic going on in there. But eventually we get it, whether it's the time of Moses or later in the exile, we get the ideal. One man, one woman, because that's the reference point for Jesus. When Jesus is asked about marriage, you know, and all that, he goes back to Genesis. So that's the ideal. That's the way it should be. It's the way it should have been. Okay? But, you know, God has to invade human history after not only the fall, but after all the, you know, all three rebellions that we read about in Genesis 1 through 11. He has to invade human history, and he takes it as it is. He's going to clean that up later, but for right now, we need to start a family anew on earth, and that's what we're going to do. We have to start somewhere. I think we just need to read Scripture a little more clearly for what it actually says. And again, God doesn't endorse these cultural elements. He invades them. This is just where he inserts himself in the story. Now, none of that means that everybody, or even most people, you know, was a polygamist. You know, it's not that every man was a polygamist in Israel. We actually, you know, if you really think about it, we actually have very little information on this. It was the norm, you know, for patriarchal culture, and it functioned as a means of social welfare for women, you know, to make sure they were taken care of when their husbands died, because the husbands are the property owners and, you know, the sons and all that stuff. And you have the succession issues. I mean, the women need to be taken care of. And this is part of the way it's done, as distasteful as it is to us. This is, it beats putting her out in the desert and saying good luck. Okay. It really does beat that. So it's the norm for the patriarchal culture. It's part of the social welfare system. You know, once Israel was in Canaan, you know, once you have an urban situation, the need for a patriarchal system isn't as apparent. You know, you just think about what urbanism means for something like middle-class living. And, you know, you're not dependent on flocks and herds, and you don't need to have lots of kids by lots of wives to manage huge flocks and herds. You know, the circumstances change, but we're just not told many specifics in the Bible about how life was. So we have very little way of knowing how many families were polygamous or not. Our only glimpse into this is with the leadership, you know, royalty. And in such cases, there's the added consideration there. And I use consideration. It's a nice term. I'm not saying it's a good thing. But we have the added consideration of political and family alliances when you get into the monarchy. What we do know is that someone like David had no qualms about having more than one wife, nor is he condemned for it, so long as it wasn't adultery. He is condemned for adultery with, you know, Bathsheba, but he has other wives before that. So that's what we know. We have a kind of a spotty picture. Now this leads us to the chief exception for the adultery command in Israelite culture, and that is, you know, yes, generally taking other women sexually as wives as long as they were not married to someone else or betrothed. Well, there was actually a legal institution to do that, and that is Deuteronomy 25:5-10, what we call levirate marriage. These are Latin terms for what the passage describes. Let me just read the passage. If brothers dwell together, which is an interesting phrase, but if brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the dead man shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in to her and take her as his wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And the first son whom she bears shall succeed to the name of his dead brother, that his name, the dead person, may not be blotted out of Israel. And if the man does not wish to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to perpetuate his brother's name in Israel. Boy, isn't that cutting. He will not perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak to him. And if he persists, basically they're trying to talk him into doing this. If he persists, saying, I do not wish to take her, then his brother's wife shall go up to him in the presence of the elders and pull his sandal off his foot and spit, you know, in his face. I mean, this is a contemptible thing. For the brother to refuse to take this woman as his wife, it is a contemptible thing. Now, here's the question. What if the brother's already married? he's still supposed to take this additional woman. This is the law. There's nothing in Deuteronomy 25 about that lets him off the hook if he's already married. You know, this is, again, this is a divinely, you know, this is part of the Torah. This is a divinely ordained exception to what we would think is adultery. But the Torah, this is not adultery in the Torah, because this woman has no husband now. She is not married. She is not betrothed. He is allowed, not only allowed, but you know, the law basically wants him to take her and add her as a wife so that, you know, the name of the deceased will not be blotted out. Now, Tigay has some interesting commentary here. And again, this is, I've said before, this is my favorite Deuteronomy. I just like Tigay's commentary. He's a good writer, and it's just, he always gets to the point. So verse 5, he comments on the phrase, you know, if brothers dwell together. The precise force of this term, together, is uncertain. It could mean that the brothers are living in the same family estate, either because their father is still alive or because they have not yet divided the estate after his death. But it could also mean that they are living near each other in the same vicinity. In Genesis 13:6 and 36:7, quote, dwelling together, unquote, means dwelling close enough to use the same pasture land. In either case, this condition is perhaps related to the fact that the offspring of the levirate marriage, the brother-in-law marriage, will inherit the dead man's property. This may mean that in biblical times, the marriage was obligatory only if the lever's home, where the widow and the future child would reside, was close to that property. So Tigay is suggesting, if we take the biblical phrase, maybe if you lived like 500 miles away, you don't have to do this, because it's really connected to property. And that's possible. Tigay also comments on the phrase, he has no son. The halakha and Septuagint, halakha is again Jewish law, Jewish legal theory, and Septuagint take ben, son, to mean offspring, whether male or female. Thus, levirate marriage takes place only if a man leaves no child of either sex. This view is based on reading the law in the light of Numbers 27, 1 through 11, and that is the Zelophehad incident, which implies that a sonless man's name can also be perpetuated if he has daughters to inherit his property, thus obviating the need for levirate marriage. Now, Tigay has a whole excursus on levirate marriage, and I'm going to read a little bit of that. He writes, according to Josephus, whose view is echoed by some modern scholars, the purpose of levirate marriage is to prevent men's households from dying out and their property passing to relatives, and to provide for their widows. Now, let me just stop there. You realize what would happen. Let's say you have a woman, her husband dies, and this happens. I'll put myself into the situation. Let's say I'm the brother here. So my brother dies, and his wife, you know, is just there, and I'm supposed to marry her even though I'm already married. Why? You know, it's so that a stranger doesn't get hold of her, i.e., you know, my brother's property. The property needs to stay within the family, both for the family's sake and also for the woman, because he could basically marry, or, you know, somebody could either swindle her, or a stranger could marry her and then divorce her, and then she's toast. She is just toast. She is abandoned and alone. She has nothing. And in this society, women who have nothing are either going to turn to prostitution, or they're just going to die. Okay, they have nothing. There is no government to take care of them. So it's a serious thing for me to look at this situation and say, okay, I'm going to add her, and we're going to make sure that she is taken care of, and the property stays within the family, and the children inherit, you know, all that kind of stuff. This is what it's for. But back to Gabe. The practice undoubtedly had those effects, but the Bible's own explanation, as noted in the commentary, is that levirate marriage aims to provide a dead man with a son in order to prevent his name from being blotted out. This is the secondary concern. This reflects the belief, and this is real interesting for those who, you know, want to deny an Old Testament afterlife, okay? This reflects the belief that death does not put an absolute end to an individual's existence. In biblical times, it was believed that dead people's spirits continued a shadowy existence in Sheol, the netherworld beneath the earth, and that the living could assist them in various ways. Many of these methods involved keeping, a deceased man's name present on earth, thus perpetuating his spirit's contact with the living. Perhaps the reasoning was that just as the mention of a person's name can conjure up a very real mental picture of him, wherever a person's name was present, his spirit was present. In this respect, a name functioned more or less as an image was thought to function. Hence, in some places, it was the custom to place a person's image or an inscription bearing his name in a sanctuary, thus keeping him before the deity at all times. Conversely, one's enemies could be harmed by writing their names on bowls and then smashing the bowls, just as effigies are used in voodoo, unquote, from Tige. Now, I've commented on this before about when we get to the teraphim issue. The teraphim were probably, you know, we would call them idols, but physical objects that represented a person. Maybe they were effigies, or they're the akin of our pictures, Polaroids, if you want to go back to the 80s, okay? You know, why do we have pictures of deceased loved ones around the house? It's because we want to remember them, to sort of quote unquote keep them alive, and also because, you know, that, you know, at least for most of us, that we believe that they're honored in this way. Why do we leave flowers at a gravesite? Does the dead person like that? Well, again, we, you know, even though they're dead, we think that, yeah, this is a gesture of respect. The person's looking down on me and see, you know, all this stuff. Well, the Israelite version of that was to do what Tige just describes. You know, you inscribe their name somewhere. You maybe make a little representation of them. You keep it in the house. The teraphim were kept in the house. You know, this is why you brought the servant to the house. You know, that the servant, the slave that wanted to join the family, you had to bring them before the family. And the family, the dead, are called Elohim. You had to bring them before the Elohim. It's not the Israelite judges. Okay, if you want to get into this, we spent a whole episode, I think it was episode 109, on this. And there's another one. You'd have to just Google it. But this is the thinking. They're still part of the family. And, you know, again, I realize, again, this is a rabbit trail here, but this is the part of the logic of levirate marriage. You know, you don't want the person's name to die out. The name is going to be inherited by the son of this new marriage, this new relationship, when the brother adds the woman, you know, as a wife to his own family, and then her first son, you know, inherits the name of the father. I mean, this is the logic of it. You know, Tige adds, levirate marriage is part of the same complex of practices. It provides a man with a son posthumously to assist his father's spirit in ways just described. Given the importance of perpetuating the name of the deceased, it seems likely that the son would not only be legally attributed to the deceased man, but would also take his name as a patronym. Marriage of a widow to a member of her husband's family is also mentioned in Genesis 38. And here's where we get into the Onan incident. It's also mentioned in the book of Ruth. In Genesis, Judah, the father of the dead husband, is still living, and it's his responsibility to ensure that another of his sons marries the widow. The second son, Onan, is unwilling to provide a son for his brother. What he does is he has sex with her and then withdraws, and he, quote, you know, the King James, spills his seed on the ground. He uses her. He doesn't want the responsibility of the levirate relationship. And you notice, this is Genesis 38. This is before Moses. This is before the law. This is part of the culture. Okay, this is just part of the culture, and it gets codified in this case in Deuteronomy 25. This is an instance where a cultural element gets codified. You know, but there's a logic to it. And so if I was already married and I was in this situation as an Israelite, this is not adultery. This is adding a wife, okay, in a very specific circumstance. So let's move on. The eighth commandment, you shall not steal. Asarna lets us know again that things aren't quite as simple as they would seem here. Steal, he writes, the precise application of this prohibition is complicated by the lack of specifics. The Hebrew verb ganav may cover theft of chattel or kidnapping. Rabbinic tradition interpreted the command according to the latter meaning. Many modern scholars do likewise. Again, they think that thou shalt not steal refers to kidnapping, arguing that otherwise there would be an overlapping with the last commandment, that in the context of the foregoing items, a capital offense rather than a tort is more likely. Let me just stop there. So the argument to say thou shalt not steal refers to kidnapping is, well, if it doesn't, then this command repeats thou shalt not covet. And that's confusing. So that's why a lot of scholars want thou shalt not steal to refer specifically to kidnapping. Now, Sarna keeps going. He says, these considerations are not entirely persuasive. So Sarna's not on the kidnapping bandwagon. The summaries of the Decalogue's provisions found in Leviticus 19:11, Jeremiah 7:9, and Hosea 4:2 also fail to specify the category of theft that is intended. It would seem best, then, not to define this command so narrowly as to exclude from its scope the protection of property rights. To me, that seems reasonable. Let me read you what Pete Enns says in his Exodus commentary here. He writes, this commandment is developed somewhat in chapters 21 and 22. There's case laws. We're going to be getting into some of those in future episodes. Although the references to stealing are not exhaustive in those chapters, it does give us a framework from which to understand how the Israelites may have heard this command. Stealing includes kidnapping, Exodus 21:16, in addition to taking animals, Exodus 22, verse 1 and verse 12. And material things, Exodus 22, verse 7. Clearly, the Israelites have some notion of ownership and rightful property for such a command to make sense. Stealing from one's neighbor, as with the seventh commandment, is a threat to society. It breeds distrust and strife. Little explanation is given, perhaps because little is needed. That's the end of the Enns quote. I think Pete is on the right track here because, I mean, you do get these case laws that come up after the Ten Commandments are given, and the stealing, thievery that's described is not limited to kidnapping. It includes other things, you know, personal property. And I think that really helps us here. So I think he's on the right track. It doesn't help us, though, except perhaps, again, to tell us that we need to make this sort of wide because it would have been intuitive to Israelites, and therefore it ought to be intuitive to us. So whatever constitutes theft in our culture, it would seem reasonable to attach it to this command. And I do think that's reasonable. And Wenham agrees. He says, the eighth commandment is best understood perhaps as a prohibition of stealing of any kind under any circumstances, unquote. So I would add to that, you know, the commandment has no apparent exceptions, which is a circumstance created by the lack of any precise definition, and we just leave it there. So we have things that we would call theft today that a pre-technological, a pre-digital culture would not even have imagined. And what I'm saying is we need to still apply this command to those things because back in the day, in Israelite thinking, the command was sort of left wide open. It would have been intuitive to the culture. And so that's the way we need to look at it now. Our application of this is based on what's intuitive to us as far as theft, okay, taking property. So let's move on to the ninth commandment. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Now, Wenham makes an important observation here and one that is perpetually neglected by most Bible students. Let me read that again. Wenham's going to make an observation here, and this is something that I'm willing to say most Bible students, at least the ones I've encountered, don't even think about this. And it's an important part of the context. And I'm talking about preachers. I'm talking about even theologians, Bible students. They hear thou shalt not bear false witness. And they don't even ask, well, is there a context to that? Yeah, there is. Wenham writes, the language of the ninth commandment connects it to the judicial process in the covenant community, unquote. Now, in other words, the bear witness language here is the same as one finds in the Torah for legal proceedings. As such, the context of the commandment is the legal system of Israel. And Sarna has a nice summary of this again. He writes, each individual is here directly addressed as a potential witness in a juridical forum. This is not the same as swearing falsely, for witnesses did not testify under oath in ancient Israel. The purpose of court procedure was to establish the truth on which decisions could be based. The witnesses, whose testimony about the facts with which they were acquainted, was always given orally, and they constituted the key factor in the judicial process. False evidence not only hindered the administration of justice in any particular case, but also undermined public confidence in the integrity of the judicial system, and thereby jeopardized the very stability of society. As a consequence, various measures were taken to discourage false testimony. Two witnesses were necessary in order for the evidence to be valid. It's Numbers 35:30, Deuteronomy 17:6, Deuteronomy 19:15, and others. So you need at least two witnesses, and false witnesses were punished according to the principle of talion, that's lex talionis, eye for eye. That is, for their mendacious, damaging testimony, they would receive the same punishment that would have been meted out to the accused. Also, the witnesses themselves had to initiate the execution in cases involving capital punishment. That's Deuteronomy 13:10, Deuteronomy 17:7, Deuteronomy 19:16 through 20. I mean, that's the end of the Sarna quote. I mean, this is a serious business. Thou shalt not bear false witness. Don't give false testimony in court, because if you do, the punishment that was due to the accused is going to fall on your head, up to and including death. Okay, that's actually the context for that command. Now, we interpret that command as any sort of non-truth-telling or any sort of withholding of information. That is not the context for this command. Neither of those things. Now, I'm going to put it this way. I used to love to do this in ethics class because I think it drives home the point pretty effectively. What this means, consequently, is that this command was not given by God to forbid being tactful. The ninth command does not compel us to provide exhaustive, precise, detailed responses to questions like, "Do I look fat in this dress? Did you like dinner? Doctor, did my child suffer much before he or she died? Oh yeah, I'm a Christian, doctor. Let me tell you in exhaustive totality what happened to your kid and how much they suffered. Because I don't want to violate the ninth command." That's just bunk. Okay, that's just bunk. This is not why the command was given. How about, "Officer, what do you think happened to my wife? Oh, let me tell you in excruciating detail." Or your kid walks up to you after a game. "Did I do good, Daddy?" "Well, you did okay, but let me just tell you what you did wrong. Because we're Christians, and the ninth command forbids us from being nice, from being tactful. So I'm going to just give it to you in as many ways as I can, just so that we avoid violating the ninth command. Here's what you didn't do good." The ninth command is not given to crush people. You know, we just need to stop it. We need to look for what's going on in context. Now, there's more here. The ninth command was not given for us to produce absurd ethics or assist evildoers in doing evil. How about these examples? When the Christian quarterback looks left and throws right, I'm suggesting he doesn't need to repent. It's the same for the no-look pass in basketball or the intentional foul. It's part of the game. How about, "Are you hiding any Jews here?" "Well, yes, you know, sir, SS person, I am. And just so that I don't withhold any information, let me draw you a map in my house to where they're hiding. Because, you know, I don't want to violate the ninth command. Or let me lead you to them so that you don't waste your time or I can't be accused of withholding information." How about the drunken dad comes home and in a rage yells at the kid, "Where's your mom?" And the kid knows that the whole reason for the question is so he can beat her. "Well, Daddy, we're Christians, so yeah, I'll tell you where mommy is." Again, this is bunk. This is not why the ninth command was given. You know, a little lighter, "Are you planning a surprise party?" "Oh, yeah, here are the details. Gosh, I don't want to withhold any information." Look, this is not, again, I could just go on and on with these things. But this is how we, and I'm going to say it, this is how we, you know, we undermine, we destroy this command. We do. You know, these and other circumstances are not what this command forbids. We know this for sure because God himself uses deception to thwart and punish evil. We did a whole episode on that on the podcast, episode 210. God's use of deception to punish evil. Aside from the obvious judicial context, thou shalt not bear false witness, again, the witnessing language, the best way to apply this command is to remember that you owe the truth to those authority structures and partnerships, relationships that God has placed over you and put you in, things like the government, church leadership, marriage. You know, you owe the truth to your spouse, child-parent relationships. Okay, these are the institutional things that God has given and endorsed and uses and has put you in and put over us. But again, the point of the command is not to compel you to crush people, to crush their spirits, and to avoid being tactful. It's about truth-telling that doesn't damage fellow imagers, and that doesn't make evil easier and more possible. It doesn't proliferate evil. So let's move on to the tenth command. This is verse 17. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male servant or his female servant or his ox or his donkey or anything that is your neighbor's. Okay. Now, Sarna, again, referencing him, summarizes the difficulty with parsing this command. He writes about covet, this term. A study of the biblical context in which the Hebrew stem chamad occurs discloses that it does not signify the general human proclivity for acquisitiveness. That's acquisitiveness, to acquire things. Rather, it always focuses on a specific object of desire, the sight of which stimulates the craving to possess it. However, because of an inherent ambiguity in the biblical usages of that Hebrew stem and the verb, the meaning of the present command has been a matter of dispute. Action, not just a hidden mental state, is certainly implied in Exodus 34:24. Quote, "No one will covet your land when you go up to appear before the Lord," unquote. Yet a decidedly inward feeling is understood in Proverbs 6:25, literally, "Do not desire her beauty in your heart," unquote. Further, passages like Deuteronomy 7:25, Joshua 7:21, and Micah 2:2 indicate that chamad itself, having a passive nuance, is of sufficient intensity to stimulate active measures to gratify the desire. The issue is further complicated by such questions as whether desire or its avoidance can be commanded or legislated, and whether there can be liability for mere intention or feeling. But this poses no greater difficulty than does the oft-repeated command to love God, to love one's neighbor and the stranger, and to not abhor an Edomite or an Egyptian, or not hate one's brother in one's heart. And that's nice. It's a little bit abstract, so I'm going to read you Wenham's approach. I think it's a bit more helpful. And then we'll wrap up. Chamad is by choice a reference to an obsessive covetousness that could be the gateway to the violation of every other principle in the Decalogue. The 10th command, in other words, let me just break in. The 10th command basically is at the root of violating all the other ones. Wenham writes, "Thus, coveting for oneself the gold and silver with which idols are decorated leads to idolatry, the violation of the first commandment. Desiring the free love of the fertility cults leads both to the worship of other gods and to sexual irresponsibility, the violation of the first and seventh commandments. Yearning after the possessions of others may lead to stealing, a violation of the eighth commandment. The 10th commandment, therefore," I'm skipping ahead, "thus functions as a kind of summary commandment, the violation of which is a first step that can lead to the violation of any one or all of the rest of the commandments. As such, it is necessarily all-embracing and descriptive of an attitude, something internal, rather than a deed. It was perhaps set last in the Decalogue precisely because of this uniquely comprehensive application," unquote. And I think that's well said. I would agree that, that's what's at the heart of the covet command. It is the place where the violation of all the other ones begins. So I think it's well placed, and certainly, you know, is pretty devastating in terms of the necessity of circumscribing our behavior, not just our behavior, but our thought processes. It's James, you know, about how sin is conceived and bring forth, you know, death and all that. Now, the rest of Exodus 20, all the way through Exodus 23, verse 20, so basically over two chapters, really three chapters. The rest of that, and it stops right before, you know, Exodus 23, 20 stops right before the instruction God gives to Moses about sending the angel in whom was the name to lead them to Canaan. All of that stuff up to that point is comprised of a wide description of other laws. The context for those laws will be these first 10, obviously. But there will be laws that are new in the sense of not specifically deriving from these 10. But even those might be said to have a peripheral conceptual relationship to these 10, you know, to the Decalogue, about relating to God and fellow imagers, fellow members of the covenant relationship with Yahweh. And so we're going to jump into those, basically the three chapters. I'm going to land in different places in that material. I don't know if we'll spend more than one episode doing that, but that's what's coming next. You know, some specific sort of case laws, application of what we've just read through in the Decalogue. And we'll tackle, again, not everything, but some of the things that are interesting in that material as we keep going through the book of Exodus.
Mike, I just got a quick question about the structure of the Bible. Why not in chapter 20 there? Why start with the laws, the altars in chapter 20 rather than 21?
Oh, as far as like interrupting the Sinai sequence?
Yeah, just, I mean, you know, why, like, you know, just to break it into chapters, you know, why wouldn't they put start with the laws of the altars with chapter 21? Why is it on the end of chapter 20? Like,
yeah, I'm going to combine a bit of the thinking of that last comment about the 10th command, about how it's the springboard or the starting point for the other ones, with something we talked about in the last episode about, or that actually the first episode, part one. If this part of Exodus, like, is more clear when the laws, when the Decalogue is given in Deuteronomy 5, there it's really clear. Exodus 20, it's less clear, but there are those who argue it's still here. If this is all set up as a covenant ceremony, a covenant event, then the laws need to occur in a certain place in the structure of how covenants were written. Now that is, again, I'm confessing that's more evident in Deuteronomy than it is in Exodus, but there will still be those scholars who argue that this is why, to our eye, it looks interruptive, but it's actually following covenant formula, you know, for the whole wider event. Once they get to Sinai to when the Decalogue is actually given, it's put in that place because that's where it belongs in the covenant ceremony kind of thing. So it's a little odd, again, to our eye, but I think that's probably it's a reasonable reason. The other one is if you recall from two episodes ago, that they're situated here because not to interrupt the theophany necessarily, but to precede the case law that comes. But in my mind, that doesn't answer why you get here at the end of Exodus 20, you know, which we didn't read. You get right after the laws, it picks up, you know, with the scene. Now, when all the people saw the thunder and flashes of lightning, the sound of the trumpet, you know, they're still at Sinai. So the second explanation to me doesn't explain as well the interruptive nature of this as well as the first one. Because essentially, if you're following a covenant formula and people are reading it that way, or it's read orally, literate people in the culture are going to know why it is what it is, even though it's really foreign, you know, to our ear and to our eye. But I think that's probably the best option.
All right, Mike, we'll be looking forward to the laws here in the next episodes. And don't forget, Mike, live streaming the conference. It's coming around the corner, so don't miss out on our conference. And okay, Mike, we appreciate it. And with that, I just want to thank you, everybody, for listening to the Decalogue Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.